Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this April 6, 2023 calendar for the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our panel has three oral arguments this morning. The first one is in the matter of the civil commitment of Christopher Michael Capel. Counsel, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for a rebuttal. Bear in mind that because we're using technology today, even though we can see each other and we can see each other's names, we're only keeping an audio recording of the proceeding. So please do state your name as you commence each leg of your argument for the sake of the public audio recording that will be available after our oral argument today. If we have any kind of technological glitches along the way, if you have a hard time seeing anyone, or if there is any kind of video or audio challenges, just bring it to our attention and we'll try to pause the proceeding so we can catch up the technology to us. Counsel, with that, whenever you're ready to proceed, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Tucker Isaacson, and I represent the appellant, Christopher Capel. This is an appeal from a commitment to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program as a sexually dangerous person and a sexual psychopathic personality. Mr. Capel was committed on November 15th, 2022. Before I begin my argument, I would like to clarify what I believe is the main issue in this case and what this court has to eventually decide. The main issue is when only one independent examiner is appointed in a case, and that examiner is found to be highly credible and highly qualified to testify, and that examiner is the only examiner to testify at the trial besides the person being committed, and that examiner testifies in her report and at the trial that the person does not meet the criteria or the threshold for commitment, and the court, in their conclusions of law, only use that report and that testimony to make their decisions, can the court still commit the person? And I submit to this court that they cannot. So first, I'd like to talk briefly about...
If I stop you there, I'm not sure if the record is as limited as you appear to state. I mean, the record consists of more than just the report. It consists of all the background, all the history, prior reports and examinations. So the record isn't just limited to the testimony of two people, including the examiner.
The record that was, the testimony that was presented at trial and that Dr. Marshall based her report on was all of Mr. Capel's past records and past treatment records. It's also the interview in his current treatment records. And Dr. Marshall's report goes through all of that. And that's also what the lower court judge looked at, but Dr. Marshall's opinion is that he no longer meets the criteria for commitment. At one point, and it's not disputed, at one point in the past, he did meet the criteria. He met the threshold for commitment as SDP and SPP, but he no longer meets that criteria, and there's nobody in there, there's no testimony that was presented saying that he does continue to meet that criteria. There's only one examiner, and the only examiner says he doesn't anymore.
But as a matter of law, what would you say is the most persuasive authority that you found for the implicit proposition that the district court is bound to accept as true and give credit to the testimony of any witness, expert or not?
So that the main, I guess, argument between the county and Mr. Capel is the whole weighing of evidence argument. And I would submit that most of the commitment cases that this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court decide discuss that or state that a judge can weigh evidence and they get to decide which conflicting evidence is to be used. They also make credibility determinations.
Well just as a threshold question, and maybe if you can address this, what I'm asking is assume that the district court is going to make a factual determination even if you're correct, if there's only one witness testifying, what is the authority that you have for us that the district court is bound to accept the merit entirely of the testimony provided by that one witness?
I do not believe that there is, a judge is never 100% bound to accept the testimony of any witness. That's the point of them being allowed to make credibility determinations. Now, this judge specifically found Dr. Marshall to be credible in her findings of fact. Dr. Marshall's...
Just so I'm clear, I just wanted to give, I make sure, since you're not answering directly, that you have found no authority to support that proposition. The district court is required to accept the opinions of an expert if that expert is the only testifying witness. You there's no authority to support that as far as you found.
I would say there is no authority saying that a judge has to accept what an expert says. And that's what most of these cases are about, is a judge disagreeing with what examiners say. But the judge specifically found Dr. Marshall credible in this case. So that is why I believe that.
Counsel, if I may, I think there's a difference here between finding a person testifying as to particular facts credible and what the ultimate legal conclusion that or recommendation that a testifying expert may have. In addition, the district court is free to find testimony on certain facts credible, but on other facts not credible, which the district court made very, very clear. You know, here's what I find credible unless I state otherwise. And it seems to me that there are a couple issues here. One is that the examiner actually did conclude that the appellant met the requirements to be committed as a SDP and an SPP, but said then, qualify that. And the district court went back and forth with the examiner because at best that seemed like an equivocal recommendation. So why wasn't the district court free to say, with all due respect to the examiner, but I find the recommendation or the conclusion by the examiner that he does meet the requirements to be committed as an SCP and SVP to be credible, but not the comment that seems contrary, that he doesn't meet the threshold.
Thank you, Your Honor. So Dr. Marshall has to go through the whole history, Mr. Capel's whole history, and based upon all of the records and her interview with him, she believes that he no longer meets the criteria. Again, it's not disputed that at one point he did. But in this case, there is nobody saying that he should be committed besides the county. And so in Mr. Capel's mind, the judge went through the exact same data as the examiner, all of the same records, and didn't conduct an interview, but just read Dr. Marshall's synopsis of the interview and came to a different conclusion. And I submit that that is just taking the place of a second examiner, which the lower court judge isn't qualified to do. The whole point of the legislature allowing for an independent examiner is that it's the only chance the people who are being committed have of not being committed. So when you get a report that says, no, they don't meet the threshold anymore, there's nothing else that person can do besides rely on that opinion. If Mr. Kaplan wanted to, he could have requested a second opinion, because that's how important the independent examiner is.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Isaacson. You seem to want to give some sort of conclusive effect to this particular expert's report, but oftentimes in cases involving commitment petitions, we see both examiners, both the court-appointed initial independent examiner and the second examiner, opining that in fact a particular person does meet the criteria. Yet in all of those cases, a district court evaluates and reaches its own conclusions and findings, and this court provides a robust review, notwithstanding the fact that there's no dispute between the experts. Do you really urge us to adopt a rule where the testimony of an expert would kind of supplant the district court's own fact-finding legal conclusions?
Your Honor, no, I do not. I don't think that would be a reasonable rule to make. I think you need a judge to determine which expert is credible. And in all cases where there are two experts, their opinions are given certain amount of weight and they're determined who is credible. That's what Cable and INSEE were both about. Three examiners saying somebody should be committed, one examiner saying that they shouldn't. The judge gets to decide who to believe in those cases. The difference between this case and those cases is there was nobody else saying that he should be committed. And so there aren't facts in the record that Mr. Kappel currently needs to be committed. Most of the time when the report comes back saying that a person doesn't meet the criteria, the petition is dismissed. In this case, that didn't happen.
Do you have any?
That's why we're here now.
Do you or should we have any due process concerns applying your rule, your proposed rule, when the circumstances are the opposite, as they more commonly are? Let's assume we have a case where the only expert testimony provided, the only expert opinion, cuts against the applicant seeking to be released from civil commitment. I gather in the interest of fairness, you would say in those situations, the district court should apply the same rule and always keep the individual in custody.
I will say, Your Honor, in my experience, whenever two examiners say that somebody should be committed, always are.
Let's assume that's not correct, that it doesn't always happen that way, and that there are cases where the district court disagrees. In your view, in those cases, the district court should always be reversed.
I would say again that the lower court gets to weigh the evidence in the record and the opinions of the examiners.
Right, so but I'm talking about the same circumstance that we have here, only the opinion cut the other way. We have one opinion. The opinion says, oh, this person is still a sexually dangerous person and should remain committed. Your view is the district court is bound to follow that opinion, regardless of any other concerns the district court might have.
If that is the opinion of the examiner, and there isn't anybody else who testified that would convince the judge to rule some other way, then that person should stay committed. It all depends on whether or not there's evidence in the record contradicting what the examiner says. Now, there can't be a hard and fast rule where the examiner is always right, and that's not what I'm trying to get this court to do. I'm just saying that when there is one examiner and all the judge does is look at that one examiner's testimony and report and bases everything off of that one report and testimony and arrives at a different conclusion, that they're not qualified to do that. Again, the whole point of appointing an independent examiner is that that is the person being committed's only chance. And that's not what the rule is. But in practice, if an examiner doesn't or supports commitment, the person almost always gets committed. And if they don't support commitment, usually the petition is dismissed. This case is unique in that the examiner didn't support commitment and the person still got committed.
But does it make a difference, Mr. Isaacson, that experts who provide testimony and reports in these kinds of cases are not only giving opinions about the results of their, you know, screening tools and interviews and based on their knowledge, but they're also talking about legal conclusions and making legal assessments because of this unique statutory and legal framework we find in commitment cases. I mean, unlike somebody testifying in a personal injury case that someone has a permanent injury or someone is unable to do something. I mean, here we have this weird law fact overlay. Doesn't that make a difference in terms of the evidence a district court may rely on and the significance of expert testimony?
Your Honor, these cases are so fact intensive, and the legal conclusions that you need to make are just based on facts in the record. They're based on the person's age and they're based on the person's history and past offenses. And so you can't take the two away from each other. You can't split them. The legal conclusions and the facts that the examiner bases their opinions on are the same. And that's the same that the doctor or that the judge has to also look at. You know, you look at the records to make your legal conclusions and vice versa. And so I submit that the examiner is in a better position to determine whether or not somebody is currently in need of commitment than a judge going through the exact same report, which most of the time they will just read the report and listen to the testimony. They wouldn't go through the thousands of pages of past treatment reports like what the independent examiner does.
So is it your position that an examiner is in a better position to make the legal conclusion that a person meets the requirements of commitment by clear and convincing evidence than a district court?
If there are multiple opinions, then the judge is by far in the better position.
Opinions. I'm just talking about in this case with one opinion. It doesn't matter whether it's one or 20 opinions. Isn't it really the district court's responsibility to determine legally whether or not the person should be committed by clear and convincing evidence? Isn't that a legal determination ultimately that needs to be made by the district court?
In short, Your Honor, yes, the judge is in charge of determining whether or not somebody meets the criteria for commitment. But in the independent examiner's report, they are also required to discuss those factors. And so in a way, they are being asked to determine, can I finish my answer, Your Honor? I ran out of time.
Yes, you may finish.
Thank you. The independent examiner is being asked to make these legal determinations by evaluating all of the factors. Each factor that is necessary to commit somebody is discussed in Dr. Marshall's report, because the independent examiner has to in order to supply a proper opinion. And so they're both doing the same job. I would just submit that the examiner is in a better position if found credible by the district court judge, which is what happened in this case. Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Isaacson. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. This is Nathan Crow, Assistant Stearns County Attorney for the respondent. May it please the court, Judge Ross, Judge Bjorkman, and Judge Reyes, and Mr. Isaacson. The issue before the court is ultimately whether there was a sufficient evidence before the district court to come to the conclusion that Mr. Capel meets the criteria for civil commitment as a sexually dangerous person and as a person with a sexual psychopathic personality. And if there was sufficient evidence for that determination, then whether Mr. Capel had proven that there was a sufficient less restrictive alternative that can meet the needs for public safety, as well as the treatment needs for Mr. Capel. I think as the court has already identified, this case is a bit unusual in that the examiner, in my opinion, reaches the conclusions that the criteria for civil commitment as a sexually dangerous person and as a sexual psychopathic personality are met. Dr. Marshall goes through those criteria very thoroughly and finds and concludes near the end of her written opinion that Mr. Capel does in fact meet the criteria for commitment, but then goes on to say that, however, she does not feel at this time that a civil commitment is necessary or that the criteria are no longer met. In my opinion, the conclusion that the examiner ultimately reached there was the legal conclusion as to the appropriateness of commitment when the next determination was made that commitment was no longer appropriate. There is ample evidence before the judge that in fact, I think includes Dr. Marshall's own opinions and determinations regarding the various commitment criteria in this case. The standard, as the court is well aware, is a clearly erroneous standard. The district court judge thoroughly examined the information that the court had, including the records provided to the court, as well as the testimony and report of Dr. Marshall and the testimony of the appellant. The order is very thorough. It analyzes the appropriate criteria, and the standards, in the opinion of the judge, were met. There is, in the civil commitment or SDP-SPP commitment, there's the clearly erroneous standard. There is some, I think, there's a slight difference when there is the issue in In re Linehan, where the court in that case applied a de novo review of the evidence. However, the In re Linehan that dealt with the necessity of de novo review, that was when the examiners and the court did not, they only took into consideration the statutory criteria and not the case law criteria that were established. So I don't, it based on the consideration both by the examiner and by the district court judge, there's no need for a de novo review in this case. I don't believe there is any indication that an improper legal standard was applied or that any sort of legal or case law standard was not applied in this case.
Well, Mr. Crow, I think the argument boils down to a couple of things. I mean, you have unrebutted expert testimony here. And so I think what the appellant is arguing is that there was nothing for the district court to weigh when it came to the actual criteria for commitment. And I know the record contains, you know, kind of the pre-petition opinions and reports, but there isn't anything contemporaneous. How do you respond to that argument that this is a unique set of facts, that there really was nothing for the district court to weigh? And so it clearly erred in not following or adopting the facts as the expert testified to.
Thank you, Your Honor. In the matter before the court, I think even in this unusual situation, even the Dr. Marshall herself provided information to support a commitment. This is not an evaluator who found broadly that the criteria weren't met, that the various case law and statutory factors were not met. This isn't a presentation that involved an expert who sort of across the board said, no, this factor isn't met. No, this factor isn't met. Perkle doesn't apply. All of these various, the framework set up for a sex offender commitment, that none of those were met. The case law and rules also allow for the court to consider all of the records when making their determination. Again, I certainly can't ignore that this is an unusual set of facts, and I'm not going to ignore that. But I think ultimately, though, that it is the judge's responsibility responsibility and duty under the law to consider all of the evidence, including report-based evidence and the evidence from the examiner, and reach their own conclusion. And again, I think that Dr. Marshall herself also provided a lot of evidence that can also support a commitment, even if the ultimate conclusion was that one wasn't necessary.
Even if we agree with you, you know, as I read this report, it is confusing to really understand what Dr. Marshall was trying to say. And it may be based on her discussion of the treatment that Mr. Kappel has voluntarily participated in through the DOC, that perhaps he has met his burden of showing that there's a less restrictive alternative that's appropriate. It seems to me that is a good argument. What is missing from his plans? He's got employment, a place to live, has identified some other treatment programs that might be available. What's missing from that?
The district court ultimately concluded that there was not a sufficient evidence to show that that Mr. Capel had proven by clear and convincing evidence that he had been accepted into that programming, and that he would, you know, that whatever that programming would be, would meet the needs for his treatment as well as for public safety. I would certainly acknowledge, as Mr. Isaacson noted in his brief, though, that Mr. Capel is put in a difficult situation procedurally in this case, because he has an examiner that says, ultimately, I don't support a commitment. And it puts him in a strange position to propose treatment plans. But I think ultimately what happened in this case is that the district court judge did not find that the information or the proposed treatment, that there was sufficient evidence to show that he'd been accepted into a program that could meet his needs and the needs for public safety, which I think is within the discretion of the district court judge.
Mr. Crow, isn't it a little bit of a chicken and egg quandary that he is being put in with respect to the less restricted alternative? Because one of the requirements that you noted is that he has to be accepted into an alternative program. But how do you get accepted into an alternative program when you don't know whether you're going to be committed or not? And don't those programs often need to know that? I'm curious as to your response to that quandary that he's in.
And I wish I had a response that could clearly show that there was an easy path forward for a commitment respondent to meet those to meet that level of proof necessary to show that there is a less restrictive alternative. I would note Mr. Capel, I had made some plans for the future. He had inquired into housing and had some housing and had the possibility of some additional treatment lined up. But as you know, Judge Reyes, it is very difficult to come up with a concrete acceptance into a facility if that facility doesn't know whether you can ultimately get to that. The district court judge in the decision also addressed some concerns that Mr. Capel didn't necessarily fully accept or understand his need for ongoing treatment and the level of ongoing treatment that he would need. So I think those concerns also weighed in the judge's final decision on whether a less restrictive alternative was appropriate. Again, that feeling by that information provided by Mr. Capel certainly could have also been impacted by the opinion of Dr. Marshall supporting his feelings or belief that something less restrictive would meet his needs. But I think ultimately that was one of the concerns that the district court had, was that Mr. Capel did not understand the level of need for treatment.
I have an additional question. How do you address the issue of the fact that the district court did indeed find Dr. Marshall to be credible? And if the district court found her testimony to be credible, then why shouldn't it accept her recommendation?
It is an unusual circumstance, but what the judge ultimately decided is the legal conclusion or the legal decision as to whether commitment was necessary. I think that as is laid out in, it's an older case, but in Kaiser, where the district court judge did not support a commitment for a proposed committed person, but the two examiners both supported a commitment. The judge ultimately felt as if the judge had been, and I believe I'm getting the word right, outvoted, and then ultimately decided for a commitment, despite having a differing opinion from the examiners. And then on appeal, the court noted that ultimately that final decision as to the appropriateness of commitment was for the district court judge and not for the examiner. So it is a difficult situation, though, because I'm asking the appellate court to accept the portions of the examiner's opinion that support my position, and then not the ultimate conclusion that doesn't support my position. But I think that ultimately that the legal decision finally is the decision of the district court judge to make.
Thank you, Mr. Crow. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. I just have a few spots to highlight, I guess.
And if you could, just for the record again, please state your name.
Tucker Isaacson on behalf of the appellant, Christopher Kappel.
Thank you.
First, again, back to the weighing of the evidence issue, which is, again, what Mr. Kappel believes is the main issue in this case. In Mr. Kappel's mind, the judge essentially weighed Dr. Marshall's opinion against herself, since there wasn't any other evidence presented. And the Kaiser case was brought up. In that case, the judge disagreed with the two examiners, but they weren't found credible in that case. And the judge was allowed to differ to their opinion from people who they didn't find to be credible. In this case, Dr. Marshall was, again, specifically found to be credible, and her opinion in many other cases has been accepted to commit people. It's just in this case, for some reason, it wasn't followed. As far as the less restrictive alternatives, which is my other argument that is, I rely mostly on my brief for that argument, but Mr. Kappel couldn't have shown any more evidence that something less restrictive was available. Dr. Marshall agreed that outpatient treatment was acceptable.
Well, but the statute requires a person facing commitment to actually identify a program that is available and willing to accept them. I see Dr. Marshall referencing the CORE program as a possibility, but how does the evidence before the district court meet that statutory requirement?
So the CORE program was a possibility. Mr. Kappel had, I believe, been accepted to the Empower program, which is an aftercare program. He had discussed that with his release agent. I believe her name is Heidi Freeman. And as long as he was in one, she was okay with that. But at no point would Mr. Kappel have been allowed to leave jail or prison and just go out into the community. As Dr. Marshall puts in a report multiple times, he's under lifetime supervision. He's on probation forever. And so if that doesn't keep public safety or the public safe, there's nothing else that Mr. Kappel can do to show that, he's not a danger to public safety other than being on lifetime supervision. He can't get accepted into programs when he's facing commitment and an indeterminate commitment. The commitments, as your honors know, to the MSOP don't often expire, but they don't expire. And a lot of times the person doesn't ever get out. And so he can't find placement in places that are already lacking on beds and lacking on spots when he might just go away. And that's exactly what happened in this case. He had his housing set up. He had a job with his brother lined up. He had aftercare lined up. He also had Dr. Marshall's report, which in his mind, he wasn't going to be committed at all and was just going to be on his lifetime probation and, put his life back together. instead of that, he's now committed indeterminately. And my other argument was about Mr. Capel's constitutional rights, and I can't take on the entire Minnesota sex offender program with this one appeal. I can only focus on this appeal. But again, Mr. Capel does not believe that committing him essentially forever to the Minnesota sex offender program is fair. It's preventative detention, and he served his time. The Minnesota sex offender program is meant for the worst of the worst people. And Dr. Marshall simply giving the opinion that he doesn't meet the criteria anymore and going through everything and saying he's not one of the worst should be more than enough for a judge to say, no, this very extreme punishment is what it is, should not be given to this person. And so I'm asking your honors to reverse the lower court's decision and dismiss Mr. Capel's commitment, or on the alternative, allow him to go to his less restrictive alternative plan. Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you, Mr. Isaacson, Mr. Crow, for your arguments, your briefing in the matter. It's been very helpful. And for your oral argument today, we appreciate it. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. The matter is submitted. Thank you, and have a nice day.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.